If you have your Bibles, let me invite you to open them to that passage there in 1 Kings chapter 18. Once the kingdom was divided, the kings in the north began to go downhill more rapidly than did those in the south, although those in the south would follow suit as well. One king whose name has gone down in infamy as a king in the northern kingdom was that one called Ahab. Ahab married a pagan named Jezebel, and Jezebel resurrected the old religion of Baal. Now, Baal was a fertility god. He was the god of the sun and the rain, and he had a consort, a goddess, Ashtaroth, the goddess of the moon. And this ancient religion, in fact, it was around when the Israelites first entered the land of Israel. And it was the predominant religion. They had tried to eradicate that and had done so in many places. And now Ahab comes and he brings it all back again. It was a very easy religion for many of the Israelites to adopt because it seemed so relevant. They were an agricultural society, and this god dealt directly with their felt needs. They needed crops. They needed the sun. They needed the rain. And this was the god, so Jezebel said, that would provide for all these needs that the people had. Even more than that, this was a god of sensuality. If their life was a little bit boring, if their marriage was not the greatest, well, they could always go to worship at the shrine of Baal, and there were prostitutes who were there available to them to satisfy every physical lust that they had. So this religion appealed to the Israelites on many levels, and it had become quite popular, and there were many of the prophets of Baal who were there in the land. And Jezebel was intent on stamping out all worship of the opposition religion, the worship of Yahweh. She had been quite successful in doing this. There were no prophets who were openly allowed to worship God at that time. Obadiah had hidden away in two caves 50 prophets of God in each cave, but they were in hiding. He fed them, brought them bread and water just to keep them alive. The only visible spokesman for God, for the Jehovah God, was this man that we're reading about now, here in 1 Kings 18, by the name of Elijah. And he had had a long-running contest with Ahab. He had gone to Ahab and confronted him and Jezebel. And as God's word had said, if Israel was unfaithful, God would withhold rain from the land. And so Elijah, as God's spokesman, said, I will tell you now, there will be no rain in the land until the word of the Lord comes to me, and I say so again. And so Elijah had become the enemy of Ahab and Jezebel. But now he sends word to Obadiah, this faithful prophet of God, and he says, you go tell Ahab that I want to talk to him. I want to appear before him. Ahab had searched all over the land for Elijah, couldn't find him. And now he's ready to have this confrontation face to face with the man. Let's begin reading down in verse 16 of 1 Kings 18. So in verse 16 it says, Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him. And Ahab went to meet Elijah. And when he saw Elijah, he said to him, is that you, you troubler of Israel? Now this is going to lead to the incident that Elijah is perhaps most remembered by, the contest on Carmel, but it's amazing how quickly and how easy Ahab finds it to rationalize and to put the blame on someone else. The country is in dire straits. There's been no rain. There have been no crops. The economy that had been so prosperous is now beginning to move in a negative way. And he blames it all not on himself or his ungodly wife, but on God's messenger, Elijah. And so Elijah spells out the true source of Israel's troubles. Look at his reply to that in verses 18 and 19. "I have not made trouble for Israel," Elijah replied, "but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's commands and have followed the Baals." And then he issues the challenge that is to be made that day. "Now summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel, and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." Ahab was ready to comply. He wanted to get this man in his grasp. He wanted to finally have him. And what better place than on a mountaintop? It'd be a hard place from which to escape. And so he does this. I don't know what Ahab is expecting in the outcome of the contest. Perhaps he's hoping that Baal will bring rain upon the mountain at this time. But he assembles the prophets of Baal from all of Israel, and crowds of Israelites climb that mountain in anticipation of this great contest between the gods. And so in verse 20, we go on to read that he sends word out. "So Ahab sent word out throughout all of Israel, and he assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. Elijah went before the people and said, 'How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him.'" And here's an indictment on the people. The people said nothing. "Then Elijah said to them, 'I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. Get two bulls for us, and let them choose one for themselves, and let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. And I will prepare the other bull and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. Then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is the God.'" Now the people reply and they say, "What you say is good." You know, Elijah said, "I'm the only one." That really wasn't the case. Obadiah and that hidden 100 prophets were also faithful. But for all practical purposes, he was the only one. He was the only one to publicly challenge Baal worship. He was the only one to bring a message of judgment to the king of Israel. And now he is the only prophet of God who stands on that mountain to face overwhelming odds in numbers. There were 451 prophets that day. 450 of them were prophets of Baal. One of them was a prophet of God. And there is an important lesson that the people of God learned that day and need to remember right down to our present day. And that is, truth has never been determined by a popular vote. Truth does not stand with the greatest numbers. Whether in the polls or whether by a vote of our Supreme Court, that is not the basis for truth. Don't worry if we're in the minority. Satan has always had the majority on his side throughout history. Elijah was one against that army of false prophets. But God always triumphs in the end, even if there's one who stands with him. Well, the contest began. And you can only imagine the scene. If you've ever visited Israel and seen Mount Carmel, it's in it overlooks modern-day Haifa, right on the coast of the Mediterranean, and it sort of juts out into the ocean there. And that high prominence has been mentioned throughout history, that one of the very earliest references to Mount Carmel is an Egyptian reference in the second millennium B.C. It's referred to there as Holy Head, the mountain, Holy Head. So it was a place of religious significance from ancient times. The Assyrian king, Shalmaneser, in the year 841 B.C., refers to that prominence as the Mountain of Baal. So at his time, already it was a popular place of the worship of Baal. In modern terms, we would call it Baal's Bluff, that big mountain up there that belonged to the worship of Baal. Now, when the Israelites had come into the land and had driven many of the folks out, they had built an altar to Jehovah God up on the mountain. But now that Jezebel has come in and she's run off all the prophets of God, she had returned it to its original place of importance among the worshipers of Baal. It had become a shrine again to the worship of Baal. So here they are on Baal's Bluff on this holy mountain dedicated to Baal, and Elijah goes up there, and I wonder if that's not why he chose that place, because he was going to give them home court advantage. Right there where Baal was worshipped, that's where the contest would take place. That's where the prophets had gathered to worship their god of Baal. And so right there on their own home turf, he was going to fight the battle out. Well, the coin toss goes to the prophets of Baal, so they get to begin first. And in verse 25, we read about the beginnings of that contest. Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose one of the bulls and prepare it first, since there are so many of you. Call on the name of your God, but do not light the fire." So they took the bull given them and prepared it. Then they called on the name of Baal from morning until noon. "O Baal, answer us," they shouted. But there was no response. No one answered. And they danced around the altar they had made. At noon, Elijah began to taunt them. "Shout louder," he said. "Surely he is a god. Perhaps he is deep in thought, or busy, or traveling. Maybe he is sleeping and must be awakened." So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time for evening sacrifice. But there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. You know, the pagan gods had the same characteristics as humans. That taunt was really based on reality. He wasn't exaggerating when he suggested all these things, because the gods of the pagans had the same needs and desires as humans in their religions. Their gods needed to sleep. Their gods needed food. Their gods longed for sexual conquest, and they had consorts among the gods and the goddesses. And so he's making all these seemingly overboard jokes, but they really have a basis in the reality of those kind of pagan religions. And so he offers these taunts. That fertility god was not able to respond. That god who provided sun and rain, the god of the storm, was not able to do anything. No doubt these prophets of Baal had been fervently praying to their God over the past 3.5 years, asking Him to send rain. And yet, the God of Israel had withheld rain. And now Baal, the God who was not able to deliver the rain during this drought, neither was he able to deliver fire onto the sacrifice that was offered to him. Jeremiah talks about these false gods in Jeremiah 14:22. He says, "Do any of the worthless idols of the nations bring rain?" The answer is no. "Do the skies themselves send down the showers?" Jeremiah says, "No, it is you, O Lord, our God. Therefore, our hope is in you, for you are the one who does all this." Well, they would soon learn that while Baal was impotent, the God Jehovah, whom Israel had worshipped, he was not only the God of the sun and the stars and all of nature, he was the God who could send fire down from heaven. Now, there's one other point that we need not miss, and that is the earnestness and the demonstration of great sincerity among these prophets of Baal and their enthusiasm and their zeal for him is no indication of the truth of that religion or, in fact, of any religion. Baal worship, from this description, would have been an exciting worship to behold, probably much more so than the worship of Jehovah God. But that's not the gauge. All that glitters is not gold. And you contrast those fits of frenzy that were offered to him with the earnest prayer of a single prophet of God and the response that that gets from the God of heaven. Well, the real excitement was just about to begin, in fact, in response to that prayer of Elijah. Look in verse 30 there of chapter 18. It says, "Then Elijah said to all the people, 'Come here to me.' And they came to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which was in ruins. Elijah took 12 stones, one for each of the tribes descended from Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, 'Your name shall be Israel.' And with these stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord." Now, let me just pause to make mention here. He's preaching a silent sermon to the Israelites. He didn't build it with just 10 stones, the 10 tribes that had rebelled and left the other two in Jerusalem. He goes back and he builds the altar out of the original 12 tribes. God was not for that division. God didn't want that division. And so in building it out of these 12 stones that represent the 12 tribes, he is showing them God's desire for the unity of the nation. It goes on to say he dug a trench around it, large enough to hold 2 seahs of seed. And he arranged the wood, and he cut the bull into pieces and laid it on the wood. Then he said to them, "Fill 4 large jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood." "Do it again," he said, and they did it again. "Do it a third time," he ordered, and they did it a third time. The water ran down around the altar and even filled the trench. You know, the greatest obstacle to God being able to bring that fire down was Elijah himself. I mean, he just poured water. It was a soggy mess out there. We have a saying around here that I've heard several times about how hard it is to burn a wet mule. That altar would have been a hard thing to light on fire with all that water poured over it. It goes on to say that at the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed. Now, what sacrifice is that speaking of? That's a reference to what was going on back in Jerusalem. Again, a message to these folks in the northern 10 tribes. At 3:00 in the afternoon in the temple in Jerusalem, that was the time of sacrifice. And so at the time that the sacrifice was taking place back in Jerusalem, this sacrifice was about to take place. He goes on to pray, "O Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. Then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. And when all these people saw this, they fell prostrate, and they cried, "The Lord, He is God! The Lord, He is God!" There could be no doubt in the eyes of all those who stood on that mountaintop that day. But Elijah had prepared himself in advance for this contest. And let me just tell you this, you will never be able to stand up for God in public in the hour of trial unless you have spent time with God in private in preparation for the contest. This man was a man of God. This prayer only reflected the many prayers he had offered to God in private. All that time as he spent by the brook Cherith and in Zarephath with that widow, it now pays off as he stands publicly before all these opponents of God. Now, you can't fake in public what is not there in private. And so God answers by fire. Did you know this is not the first time that fire has fallen from heaven to consume a sacrifice? You remember when the tabernacle was dedicated? Fire fell from heaven. Remember when Solomon offered his sacrifices? When the temple was dedicated in Jerusalem? Fire fell from heaven and consumed that sacrifice. And so this was a clear demonstration to all those in Israel who knew anything at all about their own history that this is the same God who is answering today in demonstrating the reality of His presence among them. Now it goes on to say that as soon as that demonstration was completed, Elijah rounds up those false prophets and he takes them down and they are all executed. Look in verse 40. Then Elijah commanded them, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let anyone get away." They seized them, and Elijah had them brought down to the Kishon Valley and slaughtered there. You know, a lot of modern readers read this, and here they cluck their tongues and shake their heads, and they say, you know, a wonderful day of worship on Mount Carmel, and then Elijah had to go and spoil it all by this gross overreaction to these prophets. And it ends now in bloodshed. Isn't that a shame? I think when we read that, we fail to understand the danger spiritually of idolatry. All this man of God is doing is what God had put into His Word back in the book of Deuteronomy. Back up for just a moment to the book of Deuteronomy and look in chapter 13. If you want me just to read it for you, and I'll do that, or you can follow along. It's in Deuteronomy chapter 13, the first five verses. Listen to what God had ordained through His Word. He said, "If a prophet or one who foretells by dreams appears among you and announces to you a miraculous sign or wonder, and if the sign or wonder of which he has spoken takes place, and he says, 'Let us follow other gods, gods you have not known, and let us worship them,' you must not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer. The Lord your God is testing you to find out whether you love Him with all your heart and with all your soul. It is the Lord your God you must follow, and Him you must revere. Keep His commands and obey Him. Serve Him and hold fast to Him. That prophet or dreamer must be put to death, because he preached rebellion against the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery, and has tried to turn you from the way that the Lord your God commanded you to follow. You must purge the evil from among you." All Elijah is doing is what God asked the Israelites to always do. Purge out the evil from among you. Get rid of those who would lead you into idolatry. You see, the problem is not with Elijah or with God's severity or strictness. The problem is with us, that we don't recognize the danger that was inherent in this kind of idolatry. You know, you wouldn't go to a doctor who tried to cure cancer with a breath mint. God knows how dangerous this is for His people. Their eternity rides on whether or not they're able to overcome this danger of idolatry. Ralph Davis, in his commentary, writes this: "The problem is not God's lack of refinement, but our lack of sanctification. We don't understand the danger of sin. God did. Elijah did. And that evil was purged from the land." Now, today our idols are much more sophisticated than that idol that they had, that stone idol or that bronze idol of Baal. Our idols are really much more entertaining than that idol that could not speak or respond was. And I want to just ask you some questions as we close. Can you identify what your idol is? Can you put a name on it? If there was anything that could divert you from the worship of God, that could compete for your time and your interest and your money and your passion, can you put a name on that? There's some things in my life that I know that could become competitors for my faith in God, should I allow them to do that. What is most of your free time devoted to? What do you most enjoy talking about? In Colossians 3:5, Paul says, "Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature: sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming." You know, we are building altars by the way we spend our time and the way we spend our money and what we allow our thoughts to center on. And Elijah's call is just as real for us today, back in verse 21, as it was to these people of that day. "How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow Him. But if Baal is God, follow him." We sang a prayer just before I got up to preach this morning. And one of the things that we all in that song asked God to do was this: break down every idol which our soul detains. This morning, I hope that is something you meant when you sang that prayer to God, and that you will break down whatever idols stand between you and God just as surely as that idol was destroyed up on top of Mount Carmel. This morning, if you need to bow your knee to Jesus, rejecting anything else that you might have worshipped in the past, today, if you need the prayers of God's people to faithfully turn your devotions back to God, away from the idols that have misled you, we'll pray with you. If you need to come, we invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.